Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Montana, the Big Sky State, is a place of significant historical interest in the history of North America and the United States. Sweetgrass County is located in south central Montana, an area that, since prehistoric times, has been a center of trade and a historic crossroad of travel. Jack Hines worked as an artist in New York City for 30 years until 1972, when he moved to Sweetgrass County, Montana. There he began the Historic Crossroad Painting and Writing Project as a declaration of his love for his adopted home in the exquisite Yellowstone Valley of Montana. I first saw the Jack Hines paintings in Big Timber, Montana. They depict life in that area, beginning in the Ice Age, through the times of the Indians, Lewis and Clark, the fur trade, and homesteading. I also was able to listen to Jack reading from his book, Sweetgrass County, Historic Crossroad. With the assistance of Yellowstone Country and the Montana State Department of Commerce, I contacted Jack Hines and spoke with him from his home in Big Timber, Montana. I asked him to begin by telling us how he chose to create the combination of story and picture, which resulted in his book, Sweetgrass County, Historic Crossroad.
I felt that the business of quoting dates and places in a dry manner is fine for accumulating information, but it doesn't do much to present the living quality of the time or the place, and particularly when you're looking back in history, trying to associate yourself with what it was like to live in that time.
Well, why don't we do that? Maybe you can tell us what it was like, based on your knowledge and your research, to live in the Ice Age in south central Montana.
Well, of course, the research gets to be the primary factor there because that's so far behind, and with no written records to look at, you really have to depend pretty much on artifactual information. And in checking out the various artifacts that turn up in archaeological digs and that sort of thing, it's possible to start piecing together a manner of living. And you're, of course, influenced. Look, for instance, at the Clan of the Cave Bear series, where the author there has done a magnificent job of creating a fictional situation built around this kind of informational background. And that's pretty much the procedure that I followed. Plus which, if you've done any pretty isolated outdoor kind of living, you begin to sense in a hurry what it is that you're going to have to do to change your way of living to stay alive for a given period of time. And so I think you can project yourself into a situation like that, to a certain degree at least. And of course, we get a little practice at Ice Age living every winter in Montana, you know.
So that helped in putting together the pictures?
The formulation of a picture, it's kind of like doing the writing again, isn't it? Where the fictional material that went into preceding each one of the more factual chapters is not terribly dissimilar to settling down and doing a pictorial representation of the life itself. You have a fair idea about the animal population, for instance, and what it would take for the human population to exist with them. And I'm quite sure that since the animals far outnumbered the people, there was a lot of cross-current activity between one animal species and another. And as a matter of fact, the painting that evolved for that particular segment of this overall history project has brought together in the animal department a woolly mammoth, and there's a little bunch of wolves who are kind of snarling around waiting to get in on the action when the butchering starts, making the assumption that they've seen this kind of thing happen before, and they know that when the people finally have done in the woolly mammoth and he's begin to they begin to cut him up, they're going to get a piece of the action too.
How did the people kill the woolly mammoth?
Well, they had weaponry that's kind of surprising. There were, I guess one of the primary tools that they know about is the atlatl, which is kind of a weird name, and I don't have any idea what the origin of that name is, but it's essentially what they call in other circles a throwing stick. And it means that you have a fairly heavy wooden shaft that carries a stone point, and the shaft is engineered so that the point itself has a shorter shaft that fits into an opening at the business end of the longer, heavy shaft. And on the other end of that long shaft is a shallow indentation. And on the throwing stick itself, which is considerably shorter, there's a little hook that sets into that shallower indentation. And what it does, in effect, is extend the length of the arm, effectively. And modern versions of this thing, people who have made them up to test how they worked, have learned that they can, on an engineering evaluation, they can develop three times the power of a throw that comes off an atlatl as against what you can do with your arm alone.
Was that power sufficient to penetrate the fur and skin of the woolly mammoth?
I tell you a quick story about the fellow that made the atlatl that I have. He and his brother had made these things just for themselves for a hobby for several years over in the southwest part of the state here. And they looked at each other one day after they'd been fooling around throwing these things, and they said, why couldn't we hunt with this? And they questioned the local game warden, and he said, I have no idea. Can you kill anything with it? And they said, well, the early people managed to wipe out an awful lot of the early species with it, the giant bison and the mammoth and so on. And the guy said, I don't know. So he checked with the people at the headquarters up in Helena, and they didn't know. They had no idea what to say, but they were curious. So they came down, and they all went out and took turns throwing with this thing, and one of the people from the headquarters got very excited about it and was getting very good at it, but it got a little bit wild, and he threw it, and it went through the door of his car. The point went through the door of his car. So, in answer to your question, yes, it would penetrate.
And it obviously did.
It sure did. Yeah.
Well, moving on, in your book, Sweetgrass County, Historic Crossroad, you have about seven different sections of the history of South Central Montana. Tell us about some of the other sections, moving to more recent times, but staying back a little in Montana and North American history.
Well, putting them in the order that they come in the book and in the painting, the series of paintings, the next step up the line takes the more indigenous peoples another step along the line, and that happened when the indigenous population were able to get their hands on horses. The horses that had been present during that late Ice Age had long since been either eliminated or migrated out of the territory through the land bridges or whatever, but they were gone. And so the Spaniards were the ones who introduced horses when they began their adventures over here. They were horses that had originally come out of North Africa in the 7th century with the Moorish invasions of Spain, and it was a breed that was sustained through that occupation time and were so beloved by the Spaniards that they kept them. And they eventually wound up over here, and the ones that went wild proliferated beautifully on the plains, and the Indians began to acquire those horses, the Comanches primarily, and use them as trading material and work them west and north, to the point that by the 1700, 1720, around that time, pretty much all of the Indians had them. And what that affected for them was a total change in their lifestyle from being foot-bound hunters and gatherers. They became horseback hunters and gatherers once they learned how to use the horses effectively.
Do we know where that learning came from? Was it trial and error, or were there historical legends within their tribes of the previous courses that you spoke of?
Well, the Comanches and the Apaches, of course, had very direct contact, other tribes too, but they were the ones who became the primary horse users originally. And they, of course, had witnessed the Spaniards using them. And it seems that the Spanish were very, very fussy about allowing Indians to have anything to do with their horses on a basis of riding them. But the Indians were no fools, of course, and they figured out in a hurry that this is where the Spaniards had the biggest advantage over them as a society, was the use of these horses and riding them in particular. So that when they began trading, they, of course, traded them by herding the horses north up into areas where the horses hadn't settled in yet. And it didn't take an act of genius for the receiving tribes to figure out that these animals were good for more than what their original concept of the use was, which was to use them to pull travois and carry their lodges and whatever else they were transporting cross country in moving camps and going on hunting expeditions and so on. The riding came by pretty naturally, you know, absorbing that knowledge.
Travois is kind of pulling a cart without wheels.
Well, yeah, it's a couple of poles which are lashed together and lashed on over the horse's withers so that they drag on both sides, and then you build a small makeshift platform behind the horse, and that's loaded up. It can be extended into a semi-enclosed situation with bent willows attached to the two poles and a little platform of wood stretched across between the two as a base for it. And that got used for a very, very long time for transport. And the reason that they took the horse to be the ideal for that was, of course, their size. And what they had used prior to that were dogs, which were outfitted with the same kind of a pulling device, but of course much smaller because of the least amount of strength that they had compared to what the horses were capable of producing.
Jack, I'd like you to tell us about the depiction that you have of the Lewis and Clark expedition. But first, I want to mention that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Jack Hines from his home in Big Timber, Montana, about a recent book that he wrote, Sweetgrass County, Historic Crossroad. Sweetgrass County is on the Yellowstone River in south central Montana. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jack, tell us about the Lewis and Clark depictions that you have in your paintings and in your writings.
Well, in reference to the painting, what that boils down to is just Captain Clark and Sacagawea and her husband and about 12 other members of the party. What had happened was that on the return trip from the West Coast, the entire party settled in for a brief rest and reorganization at an area called Three Forks, which is where three rivers come together and form the headwaters of the Missouri. And that's west of us by about, maybe 100 miles. And at that point, the decision was made for Meriwether Lewis to take his group and go down the Missouri while Captain Clark was assigned the project of coming overland to the what is now the Bozeman Pass between Bozeman and present-day Livingston to encounter the Yellowstone River and to do the map and the research, mapping and researching of that stretch of country down to the confluence of the two rivers. And so the depiction that we have in the painting is of that small party approaching the area that they camped in. They actually occupied two campsites quite near to where we are, one west of here a ways and the other downstream a ways. And the depiction that I chose to use takes in some of the landscape that is west of us with a couple of landmark factors that are very strong. The party is mostly on foot because the ponies that they had picked up, the horses they had picked up from the Indians over in the mountain country, were really not the best of stock, and it had been a very, very tough trip. They were much too early before the winter thaw was complete. And so the horses were really pretty foot sore, and the men were carrying most of the load themselves. I depicted Sacagawea and Captain Clark on horseback in the painting, and they are approaching one of the campsites. She is, as she is often depicted, pointing. She is so well known as a guide that I chose to stay with that identity with her and that gesture. But what's happening in the sky, I think, is kind of key to the particular situation that they encountered here. There was a very heavy, heavy storm that hit them as they made the camp, and it lasted for that night and a day. Really tremendous rainfall. And so I depicted the sky in that manner, a very heavy, threatening look to it, and catching it at sunset. To dramatize the density of the cloud cover, you get a brilliant sun backlighting the figures as they're walking toward you in the painting.
Jack, is there a section of the book that you could read for us?
Yes, I'll be glad to do that. I'd like to get into just a few paragraphs of fictional presentation about the horse Indians, which I've tried to pull the reader into living part of that time with the people and their way of life. This is very influenced by the fact that Jessica and I have some pretty close associations with Indian people here. And one of the things that we've noticed, out of extended contact with them, very common sound to the way the language is used. We have a strong suspicion that this may date back to the times when speech patterns were established in a situation where there's just about no record of all of any written language. And the tendency, if you get into some of the writings of earlier Indian people, is that they speak in very poetic terms. It's just general conversation has a poetic inflection to it, the impression that we have from it. So I've tried to capture some of that feeling, what I've written in this presentation. My name is Eagle Cry. I am far from my people of the land and mountains in the white direction. It is the time of the sun going to the place of the ancestors. Now, like some other times at the end of full light, all of the land and the sky are the color of the red sacred stone. Nearby is my brother friend, Badger. He is an important man to our people. He has made many horse raids by himself, has brought many of the horses to give to some of the older ones and others who have little. Badger is also brave in the hunt, has taken many of the warriors of our enemies, the Apsarokas. Some have died at his hand. More have been struck by his bow or his bare hand to show his bravery, make the enemy look like a woman in battle. That is the greatest honor, more than peace the spirits of those we fight. I was given over to Badger by my father and grandfather. It is best for a boy, as I was then, he was such a man. He taught the ways of the horse and the hunt and the warfare. He helps, too, when I have my times with Buffalo Hump, keeper of spirits. Both have much to tell me of the animal and stone and water people. Their wisdom is making me of better use to myself and to my people. Badger and I are in a quiet, high place, waiting for dark to come. It will be sleep time, but not for us. We will be going to the camp of some Absaroka people that we had seen moving their camp early today. We know where they will settle in for their new place, be by the water that comes down from the split between the two highest places in the mountains behind us. There is a flat place near the stream where lodges can be placed and good grass is nearby for the horses. Their horses are good, with strong, short backs and rounded, powerful rumps. Their colors are fine, and their skins were shining in the sunlight when we first saw them today. The choice of a camp place is good. There will be game near, and little hollow made by the land around will be shelter from the winds. But it will be good for us also. There are enough of the always green, low-growing bushes to hide us as we seek to find and take their best horses. There is rough land, just to the white direction, for us to ride into as we drive away the horses. If we take most of their horses, they will have to follow on foot and will never catch up. Badger sleeps now. There are rocks on two sides and tall grass on the earth. We came to this place. It was right for our weight. Smoothed the grass flat with our hands. That helped us find and set aside small rocks, which would be bad to sleep on. Our deerskin bags hold strips of dried buffalo meat and hardened fat. We ate some of that and drank from a little spring nearby. The sky is clear. Day warm is still with us. But by the time we go to the Absaroka camp, it will be night. Glad for the excitement to warm us.
Jack, can you tell us about Sweetgrass County now in Montana, what the life is like, what the community is like?
Yeah. It's a ranching community, and it's, I tell you, there is such a variety of landscape here, and it leads to an awful lot of variety in the way people use the county. We have an abundance of clear, beautiful fresh water coming down off the mountains. It comes directly from the snowpack. And that water is put to use to irrigate and to help with the growth of the crops that are necessary for life through the winter. There's a constant awareness of that fact, that you're really living from one summer season to the next and hoping for the winter to do what it's supposed to be doing in terms of snowfall to create that snowpack.
What is the typical amount of snowfall each year?
It would be hard to tell you about snowfall. There's a variable. I've seen 30-foot snow cover on the little road from our town up onto the moraine. Airport is, and to the point that you can't use the road up at all. The other factor that we have going here that bears on snow cover has to do with the fact that we're in a Chinook belt, which has some complicated meteorological implications, but what it boils down to is that there are very high winds that develop here, and so when there is snow on the ground, it's apt to be moved to other quarters very rapidly by 60 or 70 mile an hour winds. Or, as often happens with the Chinook condition, the pressure system movements which take place create these high winds, and just the friction of wind in movement, air in movement, will elevate the temperature to the point that we've seen it go from well below zero to up to 70 degrees in 12 hours' time. Of course, does away with the lower-level snows. So it's a very complicated condition. A little more easily understandable is the fact that we exist in what the meteorologists term a rain shadow. That means that we have mountain ranges west of us over which the Pacific winds come through. And as they rise to clear mountains, they're milked dry of an awful lot of their moisture. Perhaps the most easily understood in most people's terms about the moisture accumulation in this place is, number one, the fact that it is really classified as semi-arid because the average moisture accumulation here is about 13 inches per year. So it is really quite a dry place, but we are blessed by what happens up in the mountains.
Well, Jack, how many years have you lived there?
I've lived here for 30 years now.
Jack Hines, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Yeah, it's actually a series of books that have kind of a strange fitting together. It starts with Niccolo's Smile, which is a biography of Machiavelli, leading up to, finally, What Went Wrong, the Bernard Lewis book, which has to do with Islamic inception on kind of a continuity of what I saw in the development of the Sweetgrass County Project. One particular aspect of history leads to another in such a fascinating way.
Well, Jack Hines, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Very happy to have been here.
Jack Hines is the author of Sweetgrass County, Historic Crossroad. The books he recommends are Glow Smile, a biography of Machiavelli, and What Went Wrong by Bernard Lewis. This program was underwritten by Yellowstone Country and the Montana State Department of Commerce. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, ideas, and suggestions for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next week.